Welcome to Depth of Field with Tim Bradstreet and Tom Racine.
Hey everybody, this is Tom Racine of Depth of Field. I'm just doing a quick intro here because we have two interviews that I wanted to introduce. The first one is going to be with Ron Perlman, Hellboy himself, recorded back on 12/13/07, back when Tim was in the middle of the high desert of New Mexico filming Dark Country with Thomas Jane. And Ron Perlman talks a little bit about that, and he talks a little bit about Hellboy and what it's like to work with Thomas Jane. It's about 7 minutes long. It was pretty cool of him to take time out because it was literally in between takes at 3 a.m. Keep that in mind in New Mexico. And he had just gotten off a 127-day shoot from Hellboy and was nice enough just to spend some time talking to us. So it's a pretty cool interview. And right after that, we go right into the holy grail of interviews. We finally got Thomas Jane to come in and talk about Dark Country and, of course, a million other things as we are tending to do, just rambling around. And he was a great guy to talk to, and I think it's pretty damn cool. So enjoy the following two interviews. It's a long one, so pop some popcorn and enjoy.
Hey,
Tim Bradstreet.
Yeah, so I'm sitting right next to the Pearl.
Ron Perlman on the phone. This is going to be great.
Yeah, it'll be good times.
So can you give us a quick intro? How things been going there with him?
Great. We've got a ton of shots out of the way tonight. He's been up since early this morning because he flew back in today from the holidays.
Wow.
So he's a little beaten around the bush. But I think that provides for a nice deadpan interview.
Well, it's extremely nice of him to do this, so this is very cool.
Yeah, he's been great and wonderful of him to accommodate us here. So, mucho fantástico. He's taking care of a friend of ours right now, signing some stuff for him, and as soon as he's done, I'll hand him over to you.
Excellent. It's late at night. Pardon my voice. Pardon Tim's voice. It's even later for him. And they're on the set actually working. So we're going to try to get Ron Perlman for a couple of minutes here and just talk to him for a sweet.
There's 35 people like setting up a shot behind it. So it's pretty crazy.
Well, we'll do the best we can.
Pell-mell craziness, God bless America. So
I'll
put my finishing touches on this signature and I'll hand you over. All right, I think I'm gonna pass you right now.
The next voice you hear.
This is Tom.
Hey Tom, how are you, man?
Ron Perlman, how you doing?
Good.
This is really, really nice of you to do. Thank you so much.
Oh man, well, whatever I can do for the cause. Yeah.
So very quickly, I know you don't have a lot of time, so I just want to say, you just got off shooting 107 days on Hellboy 2, right?
Yes, that's correct.
Sir. That's amazing for you to go straight to this film. That's you need to take more vacation time, I think.
Well, you know what? You get plenty of sleep when you die.
Good point. So what's it been like?
Gotta make hay while the sun is shining.
That's right. What's it been like out there in the desert working with Thomas Jane?
It's a pleasure. You know, aside from the cold nights, it's really brutal down here, man.
Yeah,
you know,
in the middle of the night, too.
And it's real cold at night.
Yeah.
And I came down here with a pretty low resistance because the other one beat the living daylights out of me.
I can imagine.
But, it's a pleasure working with Thomas. It's a pleasure working with the whole crew here, man. It's all hard.
What's it like in general working with actors who are directors? I'm sure you've done that before. Is it a plus for you or?
Well, you know, I mean, my first relationship with Thomas was just actor to actor, and this is a slightly different dimension. But I'm kind of watching him. Utilize a different side of his brain, and he's really rising to the occasion, man. He knows his stuff. You know, he's done his homework, and he comes to the party, full blown.
Yeah,
there's a learning curve here.
Everything we've been talking about with the
sure-handed experience.
Yeah, with the 3D, he seems to be really on top of everything that's going on. Is there a nice kind of a shorthand between you guys because you're actors? I mean, is it easy to communicate with him about what's going on?
Well, I think his style of directing actors is basically a cast who he thinks he wants to see play the role and then leaves him alone.
That's great.
And there's a lot of directors that work that way. It's nice because it's basically a foundation of trust and high regard, you know, and so it's really empowering.
Is this something you would want to do? Have you ever thought about wanting to direct or?
Yeah, there's I do want to direct. But watching Thomas do it and seeing how complex it is, I'm not sure I got the bones for it. But there's a script I've had for a number of years that I've been trying to get put together. And every time I get close to focusing in on it, I get some acting gigs in place and takes the focus out of the equation. So one of these days.
I think the last thing I really wanted to ask you, I know you don't have a lot of time, was I know you've done a lot of stage work. I was born in New York. I know you were born in New York, and you've been on Broadway. Do you still do a lot of stage work? Is that something you'd like to go back to?
No, I haven't done any stage work in about 12 years.
Hmm.
And it'll be at least another 12 years before I do any more. I've just fallen in love with cinema. You know, I just like movie acting, and I like the movie experience. I like the fact that you pack your suitcase, go someplace. You know, you shoot a scene, and you get the scene, you never have to shoot it again, and move on. You know, it's different. It requires a slightly different set of skills, but it's what I prefer at this point.
How are you enjoying this particular movie? I know we don't know a lot of details about the script, and I'm sure you can't give anything, but how are you enjoying this part?
You know, it's cool. It's a different color palette than I've ever used before, which is suits me just fine. You know, I like the challenge of something I've never done, and I like the writing. I like the smartness of it. It's a good exercise, keeping me on my toes.
I know the 3D process that Tim and I have talked about a lot on this probably doesn't affect you all that much. It's still just a camera, but have you seen any of the footage at all? Or
I haven't seen any footage, but I've looked through the lens, and I realize we're doing something pretty trippy here.
Yeah, it's definitely going to be a landmark kind of thing. That's pretty exciting.
Yeah, and the DP that's shooting this thing also shot Meeting Chronicles, which is the other movie I did with Tom.
Oh, that's right.
And he's the best I've ever seen.
Excellent. We're hoping to talk to him real soon.
Yeah, he's a stupendous piece of manpower.
Cool.
His images are startlingly original and edgy and unique and really compelling.
That's great. So just to wrap this up real fast, what are you off to next? I know this is your last day on the set, I believe. So what's off next?
My last day on the set, and then I'm doing two more indies before the year is out. One day on one, and then 4 days on another.
Cool.
So I'm keeping running until the beginning of 08. And then I'm hoping to take the month of January and just let the sun shine on my face for a while. Because I've been indoors a lot, working nights.
Well, that's great.
Well,
thank you for taking time out. I don't want to take too much of your time. I know you guys are busy there, but this has been really great. People are going to love hearing this, and I can't wait to see you in the film.
Well, it's good talking to you, man.
All right, take it easy, Ron.
Take care.
Hi, and welcome back to Depth of Field with Tom Racine and Tim Bradstreet. And we have achieved, as Indiana Jones did one time, the Holy Grail.
That's right. We climbed the mountain, and we finally got Jane on the phone.
Actually, Tom Jane is here to talk to us about lots of stuff. Mr. Jane, welcome aboard.
Thanks, fellas. Thanks for having me on board.
We have been talking a while since Mr. Bradstreet went out to the depths of New Mexico, standing out there at 3 in the morning, freezing his ass off. Apparently, that's what this movie is all about.
Which I totally blame Tom for. He made me come with him. Thank the good
I'm
Lord.
I'm responsible for all of it. Everybody's butts out there.
You're the puppet master, Jack.
So far, all I know about this film is that it's in 3D and it was really freaking cold. So we're going to have to talk more about that.
It's supposed to be dead as summer.
I know, that's going to be interesting. Yeah.
But believe it or not, you know, I've been cutting the film for the past couple months, and I'll be damned if it don't look hot.
Yeah. Good. Well, you'll know the difference.
You rub a little sweat on people and get them to stop shivering long enough to say their lines, and it's amazing what you can do on film.
Well, the first thing that came to mind when I knew I was going to talk to you about this stuff was you're making the transition that a lot of people have from actor to director, and I just want to get your thoughts on how was that for you, the transition behind the camera, but also in front of it at the same time? I mean, are you really enjoying the process, and how did this come about for you?
Yeah, you know, I really am enjoying the process. I got to tell you, this is came about through just loving the medium of film and always feeling slightly out of control when I hand over my performance to another group of guys and sort of walk away from a project that never really felt complete to me. And then in one way or another, never completely satisfied with the results. So I made up my mind a few years ago that I would get behind the camera and make my own mistakes.
Nobody to blame, then, at least.
And then I have nobody to blame, you know.
So what?
So I said about that a few years ago, you know, started writing and seriously looking at the craft of filmmaking, talking mm-hmm. to directors. And I've worked with quite a few really good ones. Mm-hmm. So I get to learn.
Did you learn from anybody in specific? I mean, who was really influential on you as a director?
Well, I got to say that Terry Malick is probably the deepest sort of philosophical influence on me. Mm-hmm. I got to be acquaintances with Terry, and we went out to dinner a few times. And I'd say that just his sort of spirit.
I bled some stories out of him one night about Thin Red Line.
Oh, yeah.
And Tom was telling me all about how Malick would, you know, they were shooting a scene at the crossroads with him and Jim Caviezel, and with Tom and Jim Caviezel, and Terry and his cinematographer would go, "Guys, can you hold on here? There's something going on over here. There's a butterfly in this, and the sun's perfect. We're just going to run over here and shoot this for a little while, and we'll be back."
Yeah.
And I love the way you talked about him with such reverence, you know. As a huge fan of Malick's work myself, it was pretty cool getting to hear a story like that.
He broke the rules, and you know, the other thing that he did, I only shot one scene with the guy. Well, I think I shot two, but and they're in the movie. He told me months later, he goes, "There's no real reason, you know, for your scenes to be in the movie, I gotta be honest." But I couldn't cut them out. I liked them too much.
Well, he cut all Mickey's scenes out of the movie, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
Rourke, who I flew over with.
And you told me a story about that, too, where Mickey was like, he gave this performance in about 10 different ways. They kept doing different...
Yeah. It was fantastic. Yeah, I watched Mickey's work, and it was improvisational, and him and Terry were writing monologues together. And they worked on it for a couple of days, and yeah, you know, just 6 ways from Sunday, you know, you do all kinds of different stuff.
It's so cool.
It was really, really good to watch. You know, it opened up the doors of film to not adhere to a certain set of guidelines or rules too strongly or strictly. I shot the movie with John Cole, and
fantastic cinematographer.
And the clouds were constantly coming over. We're shooting in the Solomon Islands, and going from cloudy to sunny and back again. And in a normal shoot, you'd decide, you know, if it was going to be overcast or if it was going to be sunny. And the cinematographer usually likes the clouds, so mm-hmm. you'd wait, you know, or vice versa. You'd either be waiting for the sun or you'd be waiting for a cloud. And then everybody'd run, scramble, try to shoot while the conditions were right, and then you'd wait around again. Not Terry, John. We just kept shooting. Clouds would come, we'd shoot, and it would be sunny, and we'd shoot. And then finally, halfway through the day, I said, "Terry, how are you going to cut this thing together, man? I mean, I don't get it. You know, we've been shooting since sun up, so you've got magic hour. And then you've got dusk, and you've got, because we shot all the way till we couldn't shoot anymore, this one scene on the hill." And Terry said, "You know, this way I've got the scene 3 ways. I got the whole scene in sunshine, I got the whole scene in cloud, and I also got the whole scene at magic hour. So I can insert this scene into anywhere in the movie that I feel that it fits.
Hmm.
And that really made a big impression on me.
Yeah, yeah. I remember you telling me that same thing, and it had to be pretty cool too to kind of just perch yourself over Darabont's shoulder while he was cutting the mist. I know you spent a lot of time in the editing room watching him kind of work his magic there.
You know, well, that was going to be my next sort of influence, I guess, if you say that. You know, I think I'm probably more influenced by guys I haven't worked with, like Walter Hill, trying to work with, and Anthony Mann. You know, he's dead. I'm working with him time soon. But Frankenheimer.
Oh,
you know, I mean, there's but Darabont happens to still be around, for quite some time.
He's, as far as we know.
And we got a chance to work together, and that was a huge influence on me becoming a... Because while I was shooting The Mist, and my movie came together,
mm-hmm.
and I was starting to gear it up. And then, so Frank, I told Frank this, and Frank said, you know, you should come by the editing room, you know.
Cool.
And I said, you know, Frank, if you invite me into the editing room, I'm going to show up. And he, so don't, you know, say it lightly. He goes, oh, no, sure, come by. And then, of course, Frank told me later, he goes, nobody ever really actually shows up into the editing room. Yeah. It's like the most boring place in the planet. It's even more boring than shooting the actual film. But I did, and I sat on the couch and watched Frank cut the film with his editor, Kurt, for
Hunter Villa.
Weeks and weeks.
Wow.
And you got to smoke cigars, too.
Yeah. And I didn't say anything, you know. Just shut up and watch these guys cut the film.
Yeah, total fly on the wall, right?
And and that really was my film school, you know.
Wow. Well, that really...
Like eight weeks of film school watching Darabont and his editor.
That speaks really well of you as a director already, because, I mean, really, if you can sit through that process and really be fascinated by it, that's just great. That just, you know, I mean, that's what you want from your director is when they pull it all together in the editing room.
That's where it all happens, you know. They're not kidding when they say, you know, it all... Yeah, the that's your final rewrite, you know, of the script.
Yeah.
That's your final draft there, and that's, in the editing room.
That's the process you're in right now, right? So how is that going in general?
All right, we're about a week out from turning in. I got to turn in a director's cut to Sony. Low-budget movies like this are always a little bit under the gun, and there's hurdles that we need to, you know, surmount at different levels, you know. So we ran out of money at a certain point during shooting, and we got an influx of money. And now we're kind of at that juncture once again where I need to, you know, show the studio that we have a real film on our hands and then get another influx of money to finish it
mm-hmm.
properly.
You were talking about...
So the pressure is on,
yeah.
as it has been from the very beginning. And, you know, I guess low-budget filmmaking is really the trenches, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
It's giving you the worst tools and shortest amount of time possible to achieve nothing short of something mesmerizing.
Yeah, something you have, you know, very lofty aspirations.
You said you...
Otherwise you're dead. You know, you get one chance these days.
Yeah.
You can't go direct. I guess you could go direct a bunch of television.
Well,
but there's no real school for directors to go to anymore. You know, you can't get a lot of work under your belt. And then come into the movie world. You know, you get one shot at it, and then that's pretty much it.
So you've got a lot right now. This basically is what we're saying here.
I think so. Yeah, I think it's more than any movie I've ever been a part of. You know.
Well, you were talking about making your own mistakes as a director. I mean, you know, as doing it yourself. What have you been learning through this process? I mean, are you happy with the end result, basically?
Yeah, it's really just a set of sort of reassuring reascertaining and her, you know, just sort of like being, it's just, what's that word when you know something's true, but you
reaffirm.
You just need to
reaffirm, I think is it.
Yeah. Reaffirm. Yeah, it's just reaffirming a bunch of stuff that I've sort of suspected, which is, you know, make your own movie. I think you have to make the movie that pleases you.
Mm-hmm.
Because at the end of the day, no matter what it does and how many people see it, it's sitting there as a living piece of craft. Mm-hmm. And there's nobody the answer for it except for me. It's mm-hmm. my movie. It really is a director's medium. It's fantastic to get great creative people together like Jeffrey Boyle, who shot the film we pulled from Newton Chronicles, or I did with Ron Perlman. Mm-hmm. And Perlman and Tim Bradstreet to do the production design, although we couldn't officially call him a production designer.
Well, that was one of the things I wanted to ask you about, Tom, because in addition to, like, you know, one of the things that I thought was really wonderful about the experience of working on Dark Country and kind of what became what I assume will become your process is that not only did it take an amazing amount of preparation, you know, working with guys like Dave Alcock on the storyboards and realizing your movie there for the first time, and then working with 3D, Ray 3D Zone to work out the story, the Bible, the 3D Bible, but you also amassed kind of a collection of specialists. You know, Boyle, Howard Smith, the cameraman, Paradise Effects, blah, blah, blah. You had this, like, team, this hand-picked team of guys that you knew you could, you know, put your trust in. And
that's right.
That was,
yeah, I had
that was
Bernie
Wrightson
cool. design the bad guy, you know, the monster, if you will, of the film. Oh, he's not a monster, but I, you know, it, might as well be.
It works, yeah.
And Tim Bradstreet, you know, working the look.
Getting my feet wet.
We had Jeffrey Boyle, fantastic cinematographer. You know, he's been doing it for a long time. I got Bob Lambert,
yeah.
the editor.
Mm-hmm.
He's just a rock solid editor. Fantastic partner, great sounding board.
He edited William Friedkin's Sorcerer.
Oh, really?
Yeah, he also did The Driver with Ryan O'Neal.
Walter Hill. Mm-hmm. And he did the Brinks Job with Friedkin. And
wow.
He did, we'll just do a filmography on Bob Lambert. He did Three Kings, too.
Mm-hmm.
So he's
he did I Heart Huckabees.
Wow.
Yeah, he's good.
That's a varied resume.
It's great. It was really great, and I think Tom will agree with this. In fact, this is kind of more of a thing for Tom, but I think that was a great pairing, putting you together with that guy, because he's got that old school sensibility that you also have.
That's right.
And this movie's coming from kind of old school in a way, because your main kind of influence for this film is film noir.
That's right.
And the cinematography of guys like John Alton, and you know, just that's where it all kind of came from, right?
That's the main inspiration for you know, and Tab Murphy had kicked around the short story for years, and I always wanted to star in it. We actually had another director attached to it 10 years ago, and we no script or anything, but just the idea that someone else would do it. But that quickly fell apart. Everybody got busy doing other stuff, and then when I seriously started considering a directing bid, the Dark Country came up again in my mind as the perfect vehicle, something that I could star in and direct, and I could get financed as a star of the film.
Not as much risk.
Keep the budget small enough so I wouldn't be risking too much of the studio's pants, and yet be able to stylistically and artistically sort of assert myself as a director. So it was really the perfect little vehicle. It was small enough that I could control it while I got my feet wet. I think a lot of first-time directors take on a project that's too big for them, and there's too many people and too much money and too many cooks in the fire for
them
to
really be compromised. Yeah,
be able to create something singular.
So
you know, it's just got all the right elements. And then through my association with Ray Zone, you know,
California
Stereo
Club.
Most of the guys listening out there probably know that me and Bradstreet are working on Bad Planet, which is our comic book. And we hired Ray to do the third issue in 3D. And Ray, I've been a longtime fan of Ray's. And hooked up with him at the Southern California Stereo Club, which has been going on for 50 years. They meet once a month in a church basement on Wilshire Boulevard.
I love that.
That's great.
And I've been a proud member for a couple of years now, probably 2 or 3 years.
He's card carrying.
Southern California
likes to flash
club.
His card all over the place.
and so the kind of like the zeitgeist was that digital cameras had just opened up, had just gotten sophisticated enough to open up the world of 3D filmmaking again,
mm-hmm.
where it could be affordable and perfected, really, because you weren't dealing with film anymore, you were dealing with a digital projector, so the information that you laid down on the digital print, if you will, is permanent and doesn't change, and you can't get a frame out of step, and the colors don't change, and you know the polarization is constant, and so it really enhanced the world of 3D filmmaking. And when James Cameron announced, you know, that his Avatar, and he'd never make another movie in 2D again. Kind of started perking up the ears of the studio, and I went through the transition where I would be pitching the film in 3D and have people going, you mean with the funny red and green glasses? To studios actually approaching me because I had a 3D film, and you started to see every other day in the paper, in Variety or Hollywood Reporter, you'd see another article about 3D. So it just became, you know, right place, right time.
I was gonna take you back a little bit. I mean, because we did an interview with Ray Zone, and it was fascinating. The guy was great. He just talked all about the process. It was really interesting, and how exciting he was now about how it's sort of come, you know, to into its own now. But how did you get that interested in 3D years ago? I mean, because he said he met you many, many years ago. What is it about 3D that brought you into the whole thing in the first place?
Well, you know, when I was a kid, I bought a copy of Alien Worlds 3D, mm-hmm. sort of an Alien Worlds special, Pacific Comics. They had a series that were very similar to the old DC comics, Tales from the Crypt and Weird Science Fantasy. Pacific Comics started, and specifically Bruce Jones wrote a couple of books. One was called Twisted Tales, Bruce. And the other was called Alien Worlds. And they kind of revived the great art, short stories, and really terrific stories for a brief period of time. And of course, I was at the perfect age to appreciate these books. I was 14 to 16 or something like that. And that's when, in the EC, because EC put out a 3D special, Tales from the Crypt, and so Alien World, Pacific also put out a 3D Alien Worlds, and that's when that just kind of knocked my socks off, you know. Ray's got a quote, those who are psychophysically susceptible to the effect, to the stereoscopic effect, are in for a real kick, you know. It's true, there's not everyone, but a certain slice of people get a real visual charge out of seeing images in 3D.
Mm-hmm.
And almost everyone can appreciate a 3D image. But there's also something, it's almost like a drug, where you put on the glasses and you see an image in 3D. It's hypnotizing, captivating. I don't know if it releases endorphins in your brain. I'm not sure what it does, but it takes you to another dimension, literally.
Mm-hmm.
So the idea of 3D film has always been, since the birth of film, and Ray Zon has literally written the book on it, called History of Stereoscopic Film. So I got in the other room. the title, but you know, since the birth of film, that people have been experimenting with 3D images. You know, mm-hmm. Thomas Edison was experimenting with 3D projectors and images and cameras. So it's always been kind of the holy grail of film. And if we can, and I believe, you know, that this is the beginning of where we're technologically ready to birth a new language in film, or add to the language of film. As the language of film is constantly evolving from the silent films on
up. Evolutionary scale, in a way.
Mm-hmm. The way that we're able to interpret film, you know, that, you know, you see that the cutting pace has gotten faster, the sounds have gotten quicker, we're able to absorb a lot more information much quicker than we used to.
Well, then,
if you watch the old movies, they seem a little they can seem a little staid at times, because we're being told information that us as a modern audience has already gathered,
right,
you know,
right.
in one shot.
Mm-hmm.
But they'll take, you know, four or five shots and a lot of expositional dialogue to tell us the same thing.
Yeah, it's like the evolution.
Mm-hmm.
So that speaks to the evolution of a film language that everyone inherently learns, just like we learn English from watching television and the movies. And it's an inherent, important language. And 3D is like a new vocabulary. It's like a brand, it's like, you know, it's fantastic. It's like what 5.1 surround sound did for cinema, and then before that, CinemaScope. Before that, color, and before that, sound. You know, it's the next evolutionary leap.
Well, it definitely feels like it's coming from it's moving from the novelty phase, you know, with monsters coming at you, to serious cinema. And that's one of the things that struck me about talking to Raison and to talking to Tim about this film, is that this doesn't sound like a typical 3D film. I mean, it's a film noir thriller set in the New Mexico desert. You know, it doesn't scream 3D. And I love the fact that it's going to be a story film, a story-driven character film, that happens to be in 3D. It's like 3D isn't the point, and not like, you know, you're not going to put out the big glasses and try to get monsters. You're making a movie that happens to be in 3D, and I think that's groundbreaking. I mean, this is really groundbreaking stuff.
You know, it's also true that like, I remember Tom had said this many times on the set, was that we would never set up a shot for 3D's sake necessarily.
Right.
It was like the 3D, the cameras just are observing everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there wasn't any kind of setup where we did where, well, this, you know, we're doing this specifically for 3D. And that, is
right,
that,
or
is that
at
accurate?
Least we're trying to hide the 3D inside the story. You know? So we're trying to put the story first. In other words, there needs to be a justification for.
Yeah, there were definitely beats where we took advantage of it, but it was never like, oh, well, we have to have this in simply because it'd be a cool 3D shot.
Yeah, right. Point the sword at the camera.
Yeah, you
know,
yeah.
Like, well, that's what we're trying to do, and I think what we've achieved in a lot of places in the film is use the experience of observing a stereoscopic image, observing a three-dimensional image. We're using that experience to enhance and forward the plot, the story, and you know, conversely, your participation in your immersion in the story, you know, and that's what movies is all about.
You know,
you want to get a good seat in the theater so you can kind of get lost and taken away in a good movie.
Right.
And 3D's shouldn't be anything other than enhancing that experience. You should, in my opinion, in a perfect 3D film, forget that you're watching a stereoscopic image.
Mm-hmm.
You should be absorbed in the story and the experience of the film. And the 3D is enhancing that experience in a way that almost works on you on a subconscious level. Now, and that's the idea, you know, that was the idea of telling this story in 3D, and it really is, you're right, on the surface, not something you think about as being conducive to 3D, but when you get into the locale, and which was and the set, which was mostly the inside of a 1961 Dodge Polara, you really start to understand the value of 3D, because so much of the film takes place in a car. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so much of our lives take place in a car. We fight with our girlfriends in a car, you know, we drive to and from dates, or weddings, mm-hmm. you know, funerals, I mean, hospitals to have our kids. you know, it's so much of our lives take place in a car mm-hmm. that, and our lives are, of course, experienced stereoscopically with two eyes. The car is, for my money, the perfect scenario to set three-dimensional film in. There's just so much to take advantage of. Hmm. And enhance that experience. Because of our innate, unconscious, and conscious relationship with automobiles, you're instantly set into a mood and a feeling. When you're sitting in a car, we're watching a couple sitting in the car, and the camera is in the back seat. Man, God damn it, when you're watching it in stereo, you feel like you're sitting in the back seat of that car.
Yeah.
Mm. You know? And that really is, and when you have a shot from the POV of the driver looking at the girl next to you, man, you feel like you're sitting in the driver's seat.
So it actually is kind of funny, because I think a lot of people associate 3D with these big, epic, sweeping things, but what you're talking about is making the intimate experience that much more intimate, really. Like, you're
exactly
literally
right.
Sitting in the car just watching this go on around you.
That's exactly right. What we're talking about is trying to bring the intimate
you're a participant.
To life. Or get even, you know, we're trying to get closer. and that's what the film sets out to achieve. And so the noir element of the film, where we deal with, you know, noir classically deals with the psychologies, or slightly perhaps darker psychologies of the aspects of the human psyche, then that also lends itself to the stereoscopic
mm-hmm.
Image. You know, and what we're looking at basically is a subjective camera. Mm-hmm. Anything subjective in 3D, for my money, becomes very powerful.
Yeah.
Because you're witnessing something through a pair of eyes. And in a subjective filmmaking, something that Hitchcock was so good at,
mm-hmm.
Is really one of the most powerful, modes or methods or languages of film that we have.
Where did you get your love of film noir? I mean, that's not something that everybody has. I mean, it's one of those sort of, it was very small period in Hollywood's history that's actually very influential, but where did you get your love of that from?
Yeah, about a 10-year period in Hollywood after the war. Mm-hmm. People were disaffected by the disillusionments that had evolved out of World War II. You know, America was suddenly not the bright and beautiful country that it was in 1940.
Mm-hmm.
In a very short period of time, we had to look at some incredibly ugly aspects of the world and of ourselves. America was late getting into the war. We suffered terribly. Although we won, we basically had lost our innocence after World War II. And a period broke out of films that were very dark and dealt with the darker side of humanity and the disillusionment of living. And unknowingly, a group of films came out during that period that the French recognized posthumously, if you will. In other words, after the period had ended, because there was a ban on American films, so the French actually didn't get to see these films until years after they were made.
Mm-hmm.
But when they did, they immediately recognized this trend, this darker trend in filmmaking, which was really bred out of the disillusionment that artists were experiencing and thus mirroring in their art, and the low-budget film. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
Films didn't have the money to build elaborate sets, or they were reusing sets from A Pictures. So to disguise them or to make them look, you know, better, more mysterious, more filmic, they'd throw a bunch of shadows in there and, you know, start lighting it from a hard light, from an odd angle. And that, coupled with the psychological complexity of these movies, film noir was born. And I think any serious lover of film has to find a place in their heart for film noir, you know. Just like any other great medium, like the Western or even musicals, you know, which I personally am not a real big fan of, but I can appreciate the hell out of a musical, you know.
Do you remember what it was that your first time you saw these, or the films, the earliest films that really influenced you?
Well, I wanted to talk for a second about, like, Tom had to turn down, he turned this down because he's not really into musicals, but he was offered the part of the Clint Eastwood role in Paint Your Wagon remake. he's yet to talk about this, but I'm so glad you turned it down too, Tom. Jesus.
I actually have Clint Eastwood singing on my iPod. I have Clint singing Rowdy. Which is fantastic, by the way.
Yeah.
Just, you know, not only can he direct and act his ass off and, you know, make the iconic characters in film history, but also he's a pretty damn good singer. It's just amazing.
Actually, I want to come back to the director as actor thing, but I do want to just sort of pin you down in terms of what film noir really influenced you, what kind of films, because I'm sure people listening to it might not know much about it. It'd be kind of like a 101 for them, maybe. What should they be looking
well,
for?
Well, gosh, you know, film noir is really prescient today. It's one of the few sort of trends or genres from that era that has survived. Mm-hmm. Intact. The movies were much grittier. The dialogue was much more realistic. The characters were unshaven and sweaty. The women were often brutal and uncaring and beautiful and devious. And dialogue was witty and fast and sexy. So there's really not a whole lot to not to like about
it's
film noir.
A much more dangerous product.
Yeah, yeah.
And it holds up, you know, today. Because if you go and look at the original Postman Always Wings Twice, for instance, or Double Indemnity, or Out of the Pass with Robert Mitchum, you know,
Passage.
Or the Great Detour, there's so much to mine from these movies and anything that John Alton shot during that time. He was just an absolute master of light. Hmm. And there's really just, there's not a whole lot to dislike about these movies. I mean, every frame, every character, every word of dialogue, it's just, they're fantastic. And to tell you the truth, they're a hell of a lot better than the movies that we're making today.
Yeah, that's true.
Generally, I don't know where this Thomas Jane guy is going to get a career because he keeps talking about story and plot. I mean, geez.
How does a guy like that make it?
How do you make it in Hollywood these days?
Well, you don't, man.
That's part of the problem.
You got to pay your own way, practically.
I was going to say that most of the film noir, obviously, was in black and white, and you know, you shot yours in color, but you shot it at night in the desert. I mean, how did you use you know, the color and the landscape to get that kind of noir look?
Jeff Boyle, who he's almost a reborn film noir cinematographer, for God's sakes.
Yeah. Yeah, Jeff saw his work on Mutant Chronicles that we did in England, in Shepherd and Studios, and I knew that he'd be the perfect guy, you know, to shoot the movie. He really is. He's my John Alton. Hmm. Fantastic cinematographer. And color is, you know, it's a great invention. You can use it in an incredibly diverse number of ways. Most of the movies that we see, the color today is frankly really boring. It's unimaginative and it doesn't enhance what you're looking at. But that's, you know, one faction. And there's the other faction of cinema which you can easily point to, which is the, you know, movies Chinese cinema. Mm-hmm. Incredible use of color.
The House of Flying Daggers and things like that. Just the color was amazing.
Yeah. Who's the guy who's a fantastic cinematographer that works with the guy that I love?
Hey, what's the movie with the guy, Tom?
The guy with the place and the thing.
Yeah. He just did the movie that wasn't so hot, but it was in it. It was called like the year 2026 or some. But he's done all these wonderful movies. God, gosh darn it. He works with an English cinematographer, I think. But, you know, just this really lush, colorful, rich, fantastic stuff. Who did Happiness? Who's it? You know?
Todd Solondz.
No, not that one.
Not that Happiness. Different Happiness.
Happy Together.
Wong Kar-wai.
Wong Kar-wai.
Yeah.
Yeah, his cinematographer has an American name.
Yeah, I remember reading about that guy. It's a British or American guy who worked with him.
Comes out of Tom's mouth a lot as well, Kar-wai.
Yeah, just gorgeous, you know. And that sensibility coupled with, you know, reading a bunch of comic books my whole life.
Christopher Doyle, by the way.
Christopher Doyle, thanks. Yeah. Gosh, fantastic, good.
Yeah. Well, actually, I was going to say that could segue us over to comic books now, because obviously with Raw, you guys are involved in comic books. Where'd your love of comic books come from? Just the standard sort of, you collected them as a kid? What were the kinds that you really enjoyed back then?
You heard about half of it, right?
Yeah, that's good. So you already talked about it.
Yeah, the trajectory is real simple. My dad, I bought a Mad magazine at a store when I was 10 or 11, and my dad told me, I used to read Mad magazine. I said, no way. He said, yeah, no, it used to be a comic book.
Mad was still kind of taboo at that time, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, so it used to be a comic book. So I kind of made it a mission to hunt down this comic book thing. And that turned into discovering Tales from the Crypt and the Vault of Horror and Weird Science and Weird Science Fantasy. And I was reading them in reprint versions that Gemstone was putting out. Gemstone, right?
I'm not sure about that.
Early 80s, you know. They were, and then there were the late 70s versions. And anyway, there were reprints of EC Comics, fantastic stuff. And that got me into collecting creepy, eerie, all the Warren stuff. And I never got into, aside from a few Batmans, I never got into the superhero stuff. I stayed with the, you know, Conan, science fiction, fantasy, Kazar, and then got into, as I got older, I got into the pre-code comic stuff and fell in love with Lee Elias and just the wonderfully lurid stuff from the 50s that I'm still in love with.
I love that word lurid. It so describes creepy and eerie and the EC and all that stuff. It's
right. So that was my love of comics, and they were also it was a literary world, and I got turned on to Ray Bradbury through EC Comics.
That's cool.
So, which I'm hoping that's what was their intention. It was like, hey kids, you know, if you like reading these comic books, you know, why don't you go check out some novels, you know, some literature. Yeah. And that was one of the great editions of Al Feldstein and Bill Gaines, that they were turning their kids on to great stories that they'd read and they didn't adapt it into comic form. So that got me reading Ray Bradbury, and that got me reading Asimov, and then it just kind of spiraled and grew from there, and the world opens up. And then I discovered Bernie Wrightson, and
Kaluta, and
Kaluta, and just all the wonderful guys that ended up sort of shaping my visual vocabulary, you know, like Dave Stevens and Mark Schultz and Al Williamson, Frank Frazetta, Graham Ingalls, you know, Johnny Craig, Al Feldstein, Roy Krenkel, you know, all these guys sort of set up the visual realm, Jack Davis, that I would invest myself in for the rest of my life.
Because like I said, you could easily make the point that, I mean, comic books do seem to fall into two categories. You've got your superhero ones, and then you've got the ones you're talking about. And those were obviously much better written. They're much more story-oriented and character-based. And I remember I had a paperback version of it was like illustrated Ray Bradbury's. It was like five or six of them.
Yeah.
And I loved those things because they were creepy and cool, and I loved the art on them. And they're so much better written than the superhero stuff, really.
Yeah, and the art is, in my opinion, on another level. You know, it's more evocative. It's people have spent more time with it. They were evoking another world, and that's really stuck with me. And I just tried to invoke, you know, with hiring Bernie to do character designs and working with Ray Zone and Tim and I have gotten to work with some of our heroes like Dave Stevens and Mark Schultz and Kaluta. On our books,
so it's
pretty stout.
So it's pretty cool that you got to start your own comic book company based on a lot of this. That's pretty cool stuff. I mean, you're obviously not just like, hey, I think I'll do comic books. I mean, you're obviously a real fan from way back, and I think that's great.
Yeah, and I wanted to contribute something that I didn't see on the marketplace. You know, when suddenly, you know, Death, you know, even Kitchen Sink was doing Death Rattle. That died out. Just everything was died out, you know. The closest you could get to anything interesting was the Vertigo stuff, and that really wasn't turning me on.
Yeah, it really wasn't so much science fiction as more fantasy, you know, like Sandman and horror and fantasy, you know, and magic.
It just seemed to have died. You know, that said, what was rolling really strong, and I think was a direct outcropping and influence of the EC days and good storytelling, was the stuff by Charles Burns, you know, Black Hole.
Right.
And then Thomas Ott was doing these wordless stuff, you know, like Greetings from Hellville and this wonderful Tales of Error, you know, and just this fantastic sort of almost woodcut scratchboard art, very evocative, and then of course, who's the wonderful artist that did does all the fantastic stuff that I love, like a velvet glove. Who's that guy? I mean, you know who I'm talking about.
I know I do.
You know, he does those wonderful graphic novels. I probably have them here. But anyway, they came out of, you know, we're watching guys like Basil Wolverton.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, and that was incredible. And then Robert Crumb. And so the whole underground movement, you know, Shelton and all these guys, they were also a big influence on. And they all loved that film noir and EC Comics, you know. So somehow there's this wonderful connection to that stuff.
Yeah, there is a really wonderful connection in it.
And that's sort of what we're continuing and feeding off of, and trying to add to that lexicon and keep that ball in the air. You know?
Carry the torch.
Carry the torch. There's a wonderful, you know, the pulps. And there's just this, you know, and Robert Williams, the painter, Todd Shore, you know, it's just this fantastic sort of pop iconology that's been born and has its roots in old monster movies of Val Lewton, the Cat People, Seventh Seal, the Seventh Victim, or whatever the hell it is.
William and Castle.
And William Castle and EC Comics, you know, and the old undergrounds.
Put a big spin on
wonderful.
Roger Corman and.
Yeah, and then Roger Corman sort of, yeah, but you know, Corman's great, but there's a seriousness to. There's a reaching for something a little more subtle or deeper.
Right.
That I think that the best pulps and the best comic gave you. Hence the referencing of Ray Bradbury, you know, or adapting a short story by J.J. Ballard or something. You know, it's, I don't know.
There's more substance to it. It's not just these guys were, you know, in the midst of a radiation storm and became, you know, it's like,
when they get angry, right, they turn green.
There's more layers to it. There's way more layers to it. And there's usually underlying themes mm-hmm. going on. While it seems like a lot of the comics are kind of just straightforward, not to sell them short necessarily, it's a different animal, but definitely that material, the horror, science fiction, real, you know, where, because literature kind of spawned all that, mm-hmm. which is why I think the writing was stronger.
That's right. All those guys were, you know, that's what they grew up on. They grew up on the classics. And
right.
They were really influenced by early strong writers.
So why is it a toss out of theory? Why do you think it's sort of that genre has sort of, I don't know, tapered off a little bit in the last 20, 30 years? I mean, is that genre still out there? I mean, it's obviously not as strong as it was. I mean, is there... Are movies to blame? Is it easier to get, you know, really good images now? So the comics, you know, they used to be so special to see this stuff in comic form, and now maybe it's easier to see. I mean, why do you think just audience taste has changed?
Readership has definitely changed. You know, the more, use the word again, the more lurid stuff has survived.
Mm-hmm.
In video games, and, you know, the violent aspect, the darker nature of stuff. I mean, you know, that's what we were hoping to get out of the Punisher. Was hoping for a taxi driver, basically,
mm-hmm.
which I feel like we failed. But that was the, at least that was my intention.
Mm-hmm.
And I do believe that there is an audience for darker wear. I just think that it's, people have been disappointed so many times that, you know, people don't expect very much anymore.
Hmm.
For some reason, it's gotten hard to do.
Well, it's kind of funny because so many relatively low-budget horror films do pretty well in Hollywood these days. I mean, horror is actually a pretty good genre.
Yeah.
Look at Saw and all these different films that have huge box office now.
But it's not.
Yeah, it's 98% crap.
It's not intelligent. You know, they call it torture porn.
Yeah.
And that's basically what it is. And it's an interesting fad or phase.
It is. Now you can actually say slasher film, and it can have an innocent connotation to it.
Remember back in the days of the slasher film.
Right. Yeah, torture porn. I mean, you know, that's just sort of an extremist thing where you have to take something as far as you could possibly take it, which will always exist, and mm-hmm. thank God for that.
Yeah, push the envelope is always good, but...
But we need something, you know, I mean, come on, man. I saw Cannibal Holocaust when I was 15, okay? you know what I mean? I mean, you guys aren't showing me nothing. You might be showing, I don't know, somebody something, but I saw Cannibal Holocaust, all right? I've already seen it, pal.
Well, anybody worth their salt as a film goer or as someone who, like, I think it's a lot of the younger crowd that are you know, paying the box office of these horror films, the torture porn stuff and stuff like that. But they'll eventually mature. You know, it's like the same. It's like 5-10 years ago. It's like these people that love the Blair Witch, which I thought the internet campaign on it, the promo for it was absolutely genius. But the movie just dropped on its face for me. And but all these kids were loving it.
It was terrible.
Like, it's only because they haven't seen Texas.
First big movie, Deep Blue Sea, it beat it at the box office, which was a big blow. This internet, out of nowhere, tiny movie went and beat this, clobbered this $70 million action film.
Which, well, by the way, I have to say, as a fan, I love that film, just had to tell you.
So. A lot of people did, but it was too late by the time we never did recover from the Blair Witch, which was made in my home state, Maryland. It really felt like, you know, it was a low blow. These cocksuckers, you know.
That's pretty
rude.
The
movie sucked. You know,
it
literally stood up in the theater and said, "This is bullshit."
Yeah, well, you know, I was like, I guess this generation needs their Texas Chainsaw Massacre, you know, and it's like,
but it's not even close.
I know,
come on.
I know. That was the painful thing about it. And
I gotta go get a light. I'm pissed off.
It's true, though. You know, it's like I never had too much. I always thought the last 10 minutes was the most effective part of the film.
Yeah.
And that to me was depressing because I felt like I was gypped on the promise of it. But, you know, it's like I want to ask people that thought that movie was every slice of bread then, you know, 5, 7, 8, however long it's been since that movie came out. What do you think of it now? Does it hold up for you? Have you discovered new things? Have you found better films? And that's all part of it. It's exploration, right? I
wish I could say with a little bit of authority on this, but I haven't seen the film. But Cloverfield is sort of like the next generation of that, where they take the same kind of concept, but really, from what I've heard, done it really, really well.
I enjoyed it. Yeah.
Yeah. So I mean, it's the same kind of concept where you've got the handheld thing, but now you've extended it out to an actually kind of interesting story, and you've added some cool effects to it, and you know, hopefully it's maybe taken a little bit further. But
what else you got on the list there for Tom, for TJ to answer there?
Yeah. What else do you want to talk about?
I was going to talk about, well, we talked a little bit about Clint Eastwood. I was wondering just the challenges of, well, first of all, directing yourself, and you know, keeping your focus on the whole film as a whole, but then doing your performance. I mean, what kind of challenges did you face with that?
I think it was a great relief to not have anybody around to tell me what to do.
Just yourself.
Much as I love some of the directors I've worked with, love them to death, I was liberated by the fact that I could put the camera where I wanted it. I knew exactly what I wanted from a particular angle, and once I had it, I could cut and move on. It's just liberating.
It's funny, you know, if we hadn't been kind of handcuffed by the budget, and the budget meaning we could only be in locations for certain days and blah 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 permits, all that stuff, I think, just from my point of view, that Tom and the feature itself actually went really fast. I mean, once they got out there and we had all the elements we needed to do the thing, which was the challenge to begin with, was do we have everything and are we missing things? Once we had everything there, Tom was usually satisfied with takes pretty quick. I mean, he knew, and also, you know, he's very well aware of having done it so many times himself, that if you don't have the dialogue in the shot, I mean, a lot of times Tom would say, move on. Well, I don't know if we had the dialogue right. We'll loop it. We'll do it in ADR, you know. And let's move. Let's move, you know. So, I mean, I was impressed by that.
Well, the image is everything. That's one of the things that I've learned from doing it, man. The image is everything. I literally, putting the movie together, I take the dialogue from one take and put it on the image from another, and that's how you make the movie. You know, I'd say most of the time I can marry the two, but probably 40, maybe more, percent of the time, I'm borrowing dialogue from other takes and putting them with the takes that I like visually.
Yep, I witnessed a lot
of
that.
And it works. You know?
Was it hard to remain objective about your own performance in the editing room?
No.
There you go.
The editing room, what's weird is both me and Bob, the editor, refer to my character as the guy. You know, I don't think the guy would say that right now. You know, I think we should cut to the girl, and you know, so he becomes disassociated from the actor and the director, and he just becomes the guy, and he is the guy. I mean, to do it right and honestly, you have to disconnect.
Yeah.
From otherwise, man, it would become a vanity play, and nobody wants to watch that.
I'd be interested to talk to the editor to see. I mean, is it harder for an editor to work with the director who's the actor in the film too, to tell him that, you know, I didn't like that take much? You know? Did you have any problem with the relationship with the editor in that sense, or just, you know, working?
No,
with the
it's great. You know, it's great to have a sounding board.
Yeah.
And Bob's seen enough movies, and he's got a good eye and a good ear.
Yeah.
And he's, you know, it's not. What's great about, you know, working at a level that we're working at is ego, which actors are, I guess, so dependent on a lot of the time, which is why it's a peculiar combination, the actor-director combination, because ego plays a part in creating a good image as an actor, but is a deficit as a director. So it's a very interesting sort of flip-flop.
I know that Ron Perlman
has to do.
Ron Perlman paid you a really big compliment, basically saying that, you know, you hire the people you know will do the job, and you let them do their job.
And that's the whole idea.
Yeah.
I mean, that's sort of the 101 of directing. I mean, mm-hmm. Everybody kind of goes into it with that idea.
Yeah.
And then how well they sort of pull that idea off, I guess, is one of the merits with which we judge a director. It's not an easy task. Wrangling a bunch of quote unquote special people, because mm-hmm. you're not just dealing with, you know, the waitress at Denny's. You're dealing with, not that she's not special, but you're dealing with a group of talented people, sensitive,
right. Creative,
irascible, yeah. Egotistical, but talented, mm-hmm. gifted individuals, and they all have special needs. And there's tension born, especially in the specialized world of 3D, mm-hmm. where, you know, it's a very sort of a specialized, almost like a voodoo kind of a
special,
an art form.
Special club.
Right now, which hopefully that'll change.
Yeah, but, I suspect with this film, with Avatar, things like that whole attitude is going to change, that's for sure.
Well, it'll change insofar as that more technicians become 3D savvy. Mm-hmm. But what won't change is the very specific stereoscopic language that takes a long time to learn, mm-hmm. and is bound by certain irrefutable rules and laws, mathematical laws, of distance and depth of field, mm-hmm. and distance between the two cameras, distance between camera and subject, so forth and so on. Mm-hmm. That guy like Max Penner knows like the back of his hand, who mm-hmm. works for Paradise, who is doing all the 3D effects for us, and a guy like Ray Zone, who, you know, these guys are 3D experts, you know, mm-hmm. and it's a completely different set of rules that are more complex, you know, because there's a specific set of rules for shooting film, you know, to be a cinematographer, man, they speak another language. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
They speak the language of f-stops and light levels and mm-hmm. apertures and focal lengths and depth of fields and all this other stuff. And then, you know, you double that, add another camera, and then you've got a whole other dimension. Then you're dealing with a stereo window, breaking the stereo window, what's acceptable. Mm-hmm. To the eye. In other words, what's easy to look at, what's not easy to look at. It's not, you know, it's not for amateurs, you know, but it is a tool.
Right, right.
And it can be, you know, it can be mastered.
Well, that was certainly
right
very...
now, I believe there's only a few people that really know what the hell they're talking about mm-hmm. in 3D. And Max Penner at Paradise is certainly one of those people.
Was.
And, you know, and ultimately we're deferring to him, but we're also, what I'm trying to do is stretch or break a couple of those rules, mm-hmm. you know, and we'll see what kind of effect we get.
Did that ever intimidate you from the process, thinking maybe I shouldn't be doing this in 3D, first film out, the whole thing? I mean, it's a heck of a burden to
yeah,
put
right?
on yourself, yeah.
I mean, I designed the film to be small, mm-hmm. low budget, containable, few characters. But then I had to add this complication.
Fully nude.
Of 3D.
Just, you had to add that, didn't you?
And then looking back, I find that had I just been directing a normal film in 2D, mm-hmm. I would have been completely disinterested. Mm. And it's only the... It's kind of like doubling down, you know, playing poker.
Yeah.
It's like an old poker player, if you're not doubling down or risking the house, then it's boring, you know? And I didn't want to go out there and make a film that I knew that I could make. I wanted to go out there and be incredibly uncomfortable. with the idea of whether or not I could pull this off.
It's a great place as an artist to be, and that's what's great about talking about this stuff, is that you're not just, you know, some yahoo making a film. You really believe and care about this, and that's the real artistic approach there, is to push your limits at all times, and that's great.
Not to put too fine a point on it or to kind of, you know, like blow this out of proportion, but it's not unlike Peckinpah, you know, being let loose in Mexico to do the Wild Bunch, in a way, you know? The things that they did on that film, it was all a challenge, you know? It ends up being double the budget, double the time, you know? But it's almost like what happened to us on Dark Country, you know? Once they saw some stuff, they gave us some more money. And, you know, the same thing happened with Peckinpah, you know? They were like, well, we already reached our budget, we're only halfway through. And the studio head, whoever it was, I can't think of his name, said, let him go.
Right. Because, you know, he's doing something different.
Because they were seeing stuff and they knew something special was happening.
So, yeah. Going into the future here, is if you take on your next project, would you rather just behave behind the scenes, or do you really like the idea of directing and acting all the time? I mean, I know you were in this
I love the idea of directing and acting, mostly because it's one less asshole I got to deal with.
So true.
Be it the director or the actor, they're interchangeable. You know, any given day, it's like, well, at least I don't have to deal with insert A, actor, or B, director.
Right.
You know, at least I don't have to deal with a lead actor.
And assuming they let you play in the playground again, I mean, this is something you definitely want to do again, right?
Oh, yeah. Tim knows, we already have, I have a script that I've written. I wrote with a terrific young writer named David James Kelly, called The Amateur Kind. And that'll probably be my next film.
It was almost the first film,
as a,
right?
As a director, actor, director.
Was this almost your first film, said Tim?
Yeah, I mean, something that I wrote a few years ago, but I also knew that it's too big of an endeavor to take on as a first-time director and do it right. I'd rather my learning curve be with something a little smaller.
Yeah, the studio really, really loved Amateur Kind, and I think that Tom was trying to get it off the ground there. Stop me if I'm wrong. And then I think the more it sank in on Tom, the more he thought, you know, I maybe need to start with something smaller. And he threw out Dark Country at him, and they went, "We love it."
That's right.
And so Dark Country kind of superseded Amateur Kind in a way.
Would Amateur Kind be a 3D venture, or does that?
Well, if I can get, you know,
assuming Dark Country does really well.
The experiment was with Dark Country was, can I shoot a film in 3D? Use the 3D to my advantage in a storytelling manner, but not have the 3D impede upon the production. In other words, slow me down or confine me to a certain list of shots or lenses that I could use. Could I make 3D work for me and not vice versa? And I've proven that to myself on Dark Country.
Excellent.
That I can use 3D as a tool, as one would use a lens. And do anything I want with it.
So,
and that's really the proving ground of 3D. You cannot tailor a picture to 3D. You have to use it like you would anamorphic lenses to tell the story. And they can't slow you down or get in the way or they do. It does cost a little bit extra. It adds right now 10-20% to a budget. But
how does it affect?
If I can keep it fluid, then I see no reason to shoot anything that's not in 3D, because it's just good business sense at the end of the day. It's an extra added revenue stream, you know, to be blunt about it. It's something that will that you'll be able to, you know, you'll be able to download the 3D version on iTunes. You know, you'll be able to watch the 3D version or the 2D version in your home theater 5 years from now.
Is there any problems with distribution? I mean, are all theaters capable of showing a 3D film, or is there...
Well, right now we have about 1,000 screens that are 3D compatible in the U.S.
Oh, wow.
It's quite a lot.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
And by the time Dark Country comes out, I imagine that number will have almost doubled.
Wow. What kind of release date are we talking about here?
Fall of this year.
Fall of this year. Wow.
So, yeah. So, with the films like Journey 3D and then Avatar in 2009, mm-hmm. theaters are actively, and Real D, who's the major 3D distributor, they're the guys that convert the theaters, mm-hmm. And Dolby is right behind them. Mm-hmm. But right now, Real D is running the pack, and they just got an influx of, I think, about $20 million.
Wow!
To help theaters convert to 3D in anticipation of the wave of 3D movies that are coming out. Ours being one of the first.
Yes,
and
definitely.
I believe the first all live action, adult oriented or adult themed mm-hmm. Films. It'll be interesting to see. What it does, but I'm not really interested in what it does at the box office. What I am interested in is the legs that it has.
Right.
Is the life that it has. And I think that it'll have a long one.
I was going to say, you'll probably get a good luck note from James Cameron. I know that much. I'm sure he'll be interested in seeing how it does, too.
Yeah, and I'm hoping to, use that. I'm hoping to get some people on our side.
Mm-hmm.
Who can help us promote the idea of stereoscopic storytelling.
Well, it's definitely coming out of the shadows of the novelty 50s movie that I think some people associate it with, and I think that that's great. I think this is exactly the kind of film that will help that, because it's a serious film. It's a film first and foremost, and,
And it has to be an easy experience,
Mm-hmm.
It can't be hard to watch. It's got to be easy,
Yeah.
I wish we didn't need glasses, and I think that day will probably come, but it'll be a while.
Yeah.
But, right now, it's the best it's ever been. It's literally a pair of sunglasses, And
yeah.
You put them on, and they kind of look like Ray-Bans, and you watch the movie, and the glasses are light enough that if the movie's engaging enough, they go away.
Yeah, people won't even notice. So.
I've taken my daughter, who was 4 at the time, to go see Monster House, and she watched almost the whole movie with her glasses on. And that's saying something for a 4-year-old.
Yeah, completely.
So I really, that kind of told me that the future was solid if people can make the leap mm-hmm. of putting on a pair of glasses. And to do that, it has to be worth it, the experience.
Right.
And we've been talking about how the 3D is kind of subtle and not for its own sake. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we have to deliver something that's bigger and better than a 2D.
Right. People say, then what's the point? It's got to have a point to be 3D,
exactly.
But it can't be, beaten over your head like, unfortunately,
yeah.
most movies
do. Yeah, got to add to the experience.
Well, I know Tom had said this a couple of times, at least around me, where he said, people ask him, invariably, if you do another film, are you going to do it in 3D? And the answer to that, I think sometimes for most people would be like, well, if the situation, Tom says, I'm going to shoot every movie I do in 3D.
Yeah.
Because why not? Because you can
right.
also have it in 2D,
right.
And,
that's right. you always have the 2D version. And the way that I envision 3D as being interchangeable, and the way I sold it to the studio was that it's a 2D movie first, and the 3D is an enhancement of mm-hmm. that film.
Yeah.
And you can get that for minimal investment.
That's great.
So the movie has to work in and of itself. You should be able to watch it, really you should be able to listen to it on the radio, and
right.
it should be entertaining.
Right.
Really, that's my opinion. Everybody says, you can't watch a movie on your iPod. Well, I don't agree.
Yeah, I don't either.
David Lynch got on the YouTube or whatever and said, you can't watch a movie on your phone. It's just wrong.
Mm.
I disagree.
Mm.
I think you can. And I think you can have a visceral experience watching it. Not the experience that you'd have in a theater. No.
Right.
Not close to it.
Right.
But you can have a completely, just like listening to a radio play, completely different than actually sitting at the play.
Right.
But you can have a visceral experience listening to War of the Worlds on the radio.
Right.
Thus, you can also have a visceral experience watching Dark Country on your iPhone on an airplane with a pair of 3D glasses on. So yes, I think you can. But I do think that they're different, almost different mediums, you know.
Right.
And that's starting to be proven out by people producing webisodes or films that are made just for the iPhone, you know.
Right.
And they're starting to use the technology. You know, the iPhone has that. You can flip, if you flip the device around,
it becomes landscape.
The image changes, right?
Right.
And they're starting to use that in the story.
Yeah.
You know, where you have to flip the image around to see it. Where you know what I mean? So it's all part of the evolution of the language of film. And like it or not, it's here to stay. I'm one of the first filmmakers that's made my first film without the use of celluloid or tape. I mean, it's a purely digital film.
Wow.
And it's a purely digital release. We'll never see an answer print. This film will never, that's the way I sold it to the studio.
Hmm.
Said, I never want to see an answer print. I never want a print made of this film.
Hmm.
I want it to exist as a digital creation.
Wow.
Always. And I may be one of the first filmmakers that'll probably never shoot a foot of celluloid.
Hmm.
And, you know, I got mixed feelings about that.
Yeah.
But I'm embracing it at the same time.
Yeah. Well,
I'm a lover of science fiction. I love the future.
I was going to say, to change gears just a little bit before we go, because, man, we're just rambling on. I love this. I wanted to quickly get in a plug or talk about the Mutant Chronicles, because we've talked about it many times on the show. And do you know anything about when it's coming out? I know you guys shot that a long time ago, actually. It's been...
we shot it, what was it?
2005, I think, Tim
last
said?
Last summer? No, not that long ago.
Well, then he's lying.
I think it was 6, maybe.
Well, okay. I knew it was going to be in post-production
for a
year.
Long time.
Yeah.
Is that coming out?
It's been a year and a half, or close to 2 years in post.
Is that going to come out about the same time as Dark Country?
serial, you know, a movie throwback to Buck Rogers.
Cool.
I think it's being picked up by one of the majors, and it'll probably be out end of the year or early next year.
So you're going to be very busy this fall then with Dark Country and Mutant Chronicles all at the same
time. We'll be promoting a bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
And then I've got Kill Shot coming out that I did with Mickey Rourke and Diane Lane.
That comes out in April.
Wow.
I don't know. Does it?
I thought I saw an article on the wall in your editing room that said it opens April
11th. Yeah,
11th.
It did, but I think they've pushed it yet again.
Have they really? Wow.
Well, I haven't heard shit about it. April is like tomorrow. The
story keeps changing. Yeah,
they don't tell you anything.
Well, they will when it's pressing.
It was a local Cape Girardeau article. Because you guys shot at Cape Girardeau, or at least a good portion of it. And they were all wondering what happened to the film that was shot 2 years ago.
I know,
clever.
We actually did extensive reshoots. We reshot about 30% of the movie and made it a hell of a lot better than it was. And it was not bad to begin with. So I imagine that we get a decent film on our hands that they'll find an audience, if it ever sees the light of day.
When you did the reshoots on that, I know, I came up, I was in town in Toronto where you guys were shooting at the same time you're doing reshoots. Did you do it all on stage in Toronto, or did you have some location? I know you had location stuff in downtown Toronto and stuff, but did you go back to Cape Girardeau?
Let me think. No, I think we shot it all, we reshot everything in Toronto.
Gotcha.
All the Girardeau stuff that's in the film is still in the film. The Cape Girardeau folks are wondering if they'd been cut out of the movie. They haven't. Cape Girardeau is still in the movie.
And by the way, if you want to do something interesting at 3 o'clock in the morning when you're done filming for the day, not that I know anyone that did this, go to Mickey Rourke's driver.
Yeah.
He knows where the places are that are still open.
He knows where to go. Yeah. We've been there. Great guy.
Well, I think that about wraps us up, unless Tim has something else.
No. I think we covered a lot of stuff, and it was just nice to finally get a chance to... We so wanted to, you know, get you when we were shooting Dark Country, you know, like, you're in the makeup trailer, you're getting...
Not that you were busy.
You know, or whatever. Yeah, I know. Even for 10 minutes while you were getting, you know, dressed for the day to go out or, you know, a break at lunch or whatever. And I know we had the best intentions with that because you and I talked about it several times about doing something like that, but it just never kind of... I mean... Let's put it this way. When Tom pushes EPK out of the picture, Tom was supposed to do behind the scenes on location. He told him, no, we're going to do it when I get home. You guys got that done, though, right?
Yeah, we did it last weekend.
And you shot it over at Picture Car Warehouse?
Yeah, we shot it with the cars in the film. You know, awesome. Fantastic 61 Dodge Polaris in the film.
Did you recognize Rip Kalvas without his winter coat on? I know you know him from the stereo.
Rip Kalvas didn't make it, but we had some other guys from the Southern California Stereo Club come down and shoot 3D behind the scenes. I think it's the first three-dimensional behind the scenes that have ever been shot.
Cool. This is going to be a great director's commentary on the DVD track, by the way. I'm going to love
listening. Yeah, it'll be a lot of fun.
Yeah. All right, well, Thomas Jane, thank you so much. I mean, people have been aching to hear this interview, and it's been really interesting. It was great to meet you.
Comic book fans out there, Bad Planet number 5 is coming out in a couple of weeks.
That's right.
Yep.
And number 6 is close on its heels. And then Tim and I have a werewolf story in the works.
I've heard a little bit about
it. We're going to find a great artist for and get that out to you.
We hope we found our guy
before the end of the year.
Cool. All right. Well, that about wraps up. Thank you so much, Thomas Jane, for joining us. And
hey, Tom, quick question. Sorry to interrupt you there.
Go for it. I'm just trying to do my thing. You know?
I know. You're trying to run us out of here. We keep taking up more time. But hey, just as a curiosity. I know we've talked about doing San Diego this year because we want to have a black and white kind of trade edition of Bad Planet out. But how is your schedule going to? Is there going to be any conflictions coming up at the end of July? Or you're off shooting another movie soon, aren't you?
No, I'm making a movie with John McTiernan. It's basically a 90-minute car chase.
Cool.
The entire film is a car chase, which I love. Idea of that, but
you're definitely attached.
That's May. When's Comic Con?
Late July, July 25th or the 29th, I think.
Well, yeah, I think I'll be able to make it.
Cool.
I mean, we got the booth. We have a raw booth at Comic Con.
Might as well
be
there.
Won't be the same if Tom's not there. Right. We won't know what to do.
It's kind of wild, but we do have the booth, so something will be happening there.
So you will be in this movie? Because according to the god of the internet, IMDb, you are just rumored to be in Run, but apparently you're in it?
Well, you know, if they get everyone's deal done and it becomes a go movie, then I am committed to the film.
Excellent.
So I really look forward to working with McTiernan. I think he's a terrific guy.
Yeah, he's a very good director. So
very good director, and I plan on picking his brain.
Looks like he might spend some time in Argentina, at least according to the plot outline. So
Buenos Aires.
Looks like we'll be in Buenos Aires, which is supposed to be a beautiful town.
Excellent.
I know I said, Tom called me to tell me about this thing, and I went, gee, I can't really imagine it. Tom Jane car movie.
Nah, it's not going to happen.
You're not going to like that very much, especially driving at high speeds.
Yeah.
I'm hoping this is the car movies of my career, so I don't have to do another one.
You know, I spent a lot of time in a car recently this last year, the 2008 year of the car for Tom Jane.
Yeah. If this is the car movie of your career, Tom, you're going to be in a sequel, too.
Alright, well, do you have anything else before I do my thing and you interrupt me again?
No, Tom, I'm going to let Tom run off and sign off on here. Thanks a ton, buddy.
Alright.
Okay.
Thank you, Thomas Jane.
Thanks, guys.
Alright, see ya.
Take care.
Cheers.